Okay, so today is Tuesday, August 20th, and we're going to work on more chemistry information today. On page 6, you'll notice there's some information there on atomic number and mass. That's kind of where we were in class last week. And what I'd like to do is by starting with the review problem. I sent you an email yesterday. If you haven't had a chance to work through it, it was to draw an atom with 14 protons, 13 neutrons, and 14 electrons. So we'll just take a moment and kind of sketch through that one. So we've got three subatomic particles here. Which ones of those particles go in the nucleus of the atom?
Protons and neutrons.
Protons and neutrons, good. And just for a way of review, which of those particles carries a positive charge?
Protons,
good. So I've got not a whole lot of room here to work. We'll just place our first orbital around that nucleus. We have 14 total electrons to work with. Only how many fit in the innermost orbital?
Two.
Just two. So that's all it holds. That's as many as we can put there. So I'll stick two in the innermost orbital. And then I'll keep in mind that I still have, what, 12?
Yeah,
so I've got to still work with the remaining 12 electrons. So let's place another orbital here. And that one holds a maximum of how many?
Eight.
Okay, so I'll place those 8 electrons. And I'm using a negative symbol there because it reminds me of what? Negatively charged electrons, good. Looks like I have maxed out my second orbital. It contains 8, which by the way is also the number that makes this orbital stable. So I still have what? 4 more electrons to distribute, and if we're just doing the math here, 2 plus 8 is 10, and I still have 4 more to complete my 14. So let's place another orbital around the outside, and we'll place those 4 electrons out there. Now that outermost orbital has a special name. It's called what?
Valence
shell. Good. Outermost is called our valence shell. The innermost two orbitals aren't very exciting for us because, well, they're maxed out, they're full. The exciting portion is looking at this outermost shell or valence shell because we know there's a magic number for stability, and it's how many?
Eight.
And that's a rule called?
Octet
rule, right. So with only 4 electrons out here, would you say that we have met our octet rule?
No.
So would you say that this is a stable atom or a reactive atom?
Reactive.
It's reactive, yeah. Okay, so how many more electrons on that valence shell would stabilize this atom?
4
more, good. So in fact, that's kind of where we're headed today in looking at how to make that atom stable by either transferring or sharing electrons to get that magic number of 8. All right, so that's this question. We've taken care of whether or not this is a stable or reactive atom. Let's take a look at this issue here, whether or not we have a neutral atom. So what subatomic particles should we look at to determine neutrality?
Protons and
electrons. Okay, so we're going to look at those two. And how do we know? We've got 14 protons and 14 electrons. They balance, yeah, they basically strike each other out, they're equal. So would you say we have a neutral atom? Yeah, we got a neutral atom. Let me just kind of hover here for a moment on this topic, because neutral has nothing to do with stable. Stable has nothing to do with neutral. They're two totally different things. So I just want to make sure that we see that those two things don't really play off of each other. So just because it's neutral doesn't mean it's going to be stable or reactive. We're not going to make the connection there. There isn't a connection for us to make. Let's see, something else we just briefly got into on Thursday's class was looking at atomic number. And to determine the atomic number, I should always look at what types of particles?
Protons.
Good. So we should have 14. And if this is a neutral atom, meaning equal numbers of protons and electrons, I can automatically say, hey, if I've got 14 protons and my atomic number is 14, what can I say about my electrons?
They're 14.
They're 14 also. Good. The last thing we talked about real briefly on Thursday was atomic mass or mass number. This has to do with adding together what two subatomic particles?
Protons
and neutrons. So if we simply add these two together, we should have a mass of 27. Now, we mentioned real brief at the end of class Thursday, we don't include the calculation of electrons in the mass because they weigh pretty much nothing. You know, it's like getting on the bathroom scales with your jewelry, without your jewelry. You're not going to have a big change in weight unless you're wearing lots and lots of jewelry. So those electrons contribute pretty much nothing to the overall weight of that atom. If you had a chance to work on this one before class today, did you do okay with it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions about how we figured anything out here? Good so far? Okay. If you haven't yet had an opportunity to try the next one, let's go ahead and work on it. 7 protons, 7 neutrons, 7 electrons. In the nucleus?
Protons and neutrons.
Protons and neutrons, good. We have 7 total electrons to distribute. How many should go in our innermost orbital?
2.
Just 2. Are we done?
No.
What's next?
Another
orbital, good. And this time, what do we do with those electrons?
5 and 5.
5, yeah. Place 5 of them on that orbital. All right, so like I talked before, the valence shell is the outermost shell. We're only concerned with that one because that's the exciting shell. The innermost orbital has met its duet rule, so it's already full. That's not where the excitement comes. So we're going to check out that valence shell. And first thing you may notice is we have 5 electrons on that valence shell. What does that say to you?
It's
reactive, right? It's not stable, it's reactive. And you know this because it has only 5 and not
8.
Because if it had 8, you would have said it met the octet rule and it was
stable.
Yeah, it was stable. So this one also is reactive. Let's see, how do we figure out if it's neutral or not? Good. Look for same numbers of protons as electrons. Looks like you check that off. So yeah, this is also a neutral atom, just like our neighbor. All right, so how many protons for this atom?
6.
Okay, and so that tells us our atomic
number.
Yep, so our atomic number should be 7 for that reason. The mass is how much the nucleus of this atom weighs. So what two particles do we add?
Protons and neutrons.
Protons and neutrons. So, of course, that's going to give us 14. Okay. Any questions about any parts of this one? Okay. Let me take you a little bit forward here in the slides. Whoops, let's go the other way. All right, so I just want to make a mention that you're looking at a snippet of the periodic table in this picture. And in this snippet, you actually have 2 numbers for each element. Each element is represented by a symbol. And in these pictures, you'll notice there's a smaller number and then there's a big number. The smaller number is always going to be your atomic number. The atomic number tells you what?
Protons,
good. And if it's neutral, it also tells you?
Number
of electrons, good. So calcium is represented by the symbol Ca. Its atomic number is 20. I'm going to assume that when I'm looking at the periodic table, I am dealing with neutral atoms. So automatically I can say 20 is my atomic number, 20 is my number of protons, 20 is my number of electrons. Let's see, which one of these elements has a atomic number of 11?
Sodium.
Sodium, good, with a symbol of Na. And for Li, lithium, what is the atomic number?
Three.
Good. Let's see, let's take beryllium here with an atomic number of 4. How many electrons are in its valence shell?
Two.
How do you figure that? To an innermost, and then you dump your next two on the next orbital, right? Good. So beryllium has 2 in its valence shell. Good. Let's see. Let's kind of switch gears. Let's talk about the mass of an atom. The mass of the atom is how much it weighs. It's a combination of protons and what?
Neutrons.
Neutrons. Good. Let's pick on calcium again. Its mass is, what, 40? Okay, just round to the nearest whole number there. So how do I figure out how many neutrons calcium contains? Mass, which is 40 minus 20. Good. So this number, 40, contains protons and neutrons. 20 is just the number of protons. Good. So if I subtract away 20 from 40, of course I've got 20 neutrons. Just happens to be the same number. Let's do another one. Take sodium for a moment. How many protons and electrons does sodium have?
11 protons.
Good. 11 electrons. Good. And I need to know the neutron number, so how do I figure that out? 23 minus 11 is going to give us 12. Okay. Let's do another one. Let's see. Let's pick on carbon. Carbon has an atomic number of what?
6.
Good. How many electrons for a neutral atom?
6.
Good. How many neutrons?
6.
Also 6. Good. And the mass?
12.
Good. Which one of these elements contains, say, 16 electrons?
Sulfur.
Yeah, you got it. Sulfur. Good. How do you know that?
Atomic number.
Good. There you go. Okay. And which one of these elements has a mass of 16?
Oxygen.
Bingo. You got it. There's oxygen with a mass of 16. And if we wanted to know the number of protons and neutrons in oxygen, there's how many of each?
A
of each. Good. Just happened to work out that way. F is fluorine. So how many neutrons there?
10.
And you figure that out by doing what?
19
minus 9. Good is 10. Good. All right. Let's see. What is the number of protons in chlorine?
17.
Good. 17. And let's say silicon here has how many electrons?
14.
And how many neutrons?
14.
Good. Is this something that you're pretty comfortable with? Okay, what I'd ask for you to do is work on the bottom of page 6, and that had a lot of practice with atomic number, mass, protons, neutrons, and electrons. Let me hit at least the first 4 there. Since there were no answers on that page, make sure you're doing okay. All right, so the first one, number 1 on the bottom of page 6, this one has an atomic number of 5. It has a mass of 11. So we're actually working with boron. So how many protons and electrons?
5.
Protons and electrons?
5.
5 and 5, good. And then there you go, neutrons are?
6.
6, good. And to confirm that you're right, what 2 do you add together to get the mass?
Protons
and neutrons, good. So if you want to confirm that you did the work right, add 5 and 6, you should get 11. All right, so our next one is atomic mass of 23. Happened to be dealing with sodium there. And we've got number of protons are 11, so we automatically know what else? Good. Atomic number is 11. Electrons are 11. And how did you figure out the neutrons?
Good. Subtract away 11 from 23. You should have 12 for your neutron number. Good. Did you do okay with the first two problems?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's see. The next one, their number three, has 12 for our mass and 6 electrons. We've got to assume this is neutral. So assuming it's neutral, what else tells me that 6 is? Good. Protons are 6. Atomic number is 6. And it just so happens 6 from 12 is also 6. So there's your neutron number as well. Looking at the periodic table, which element was this? It was carbon. Good. And let's see. Number 4 down there. This one has an atomic number of 3. What else should be 3?
Protons and electrons.
Protons and electrons should be 3. And how do I figure out the mass of this atom? Good. Add your protons and your neutrons, and we should have
7.
You got it, 7. Good. Did you get everything right about numbers 1 through 4? Okay. Do you need answers to 5 through 12, or do you feel okay? Feel good? Okay.
I'll check. Go ahead and check the answers.
Go ahead and check those. Okay, I'm just going to read them if that's okay.
That's fine.
For number 5, your protons, neutrons, and electrons, 8, 8, and 8. For number 6, your atomic number is 7. Your mass is 14. Protons are 7. For number 7, your atomic number is 9. Neutrons are 10. Electrons are 9. For number 8, the mass should be 24. Protons should be 12. For number 9, the atomic number is 4. Neutrons are 5. Electrons are 4. Number 10 is a little different because you got, you know, different setup there. The atomic number is actually 2. Do you know how to figure that one out? Good. Take the mass, subtract away your neutrons. Should give you 2 for the proton number. So 2 is your atomic number, 2 is your proton number, 2 for the electrons. Yeah, 2, 2, 2, that makes it easy, right? For number 11, atomic number is 5, so that means your mass should be 11, your protons should be 5, your electrons should be 5. And then finally with number 12, the protons and electrons are both what?
4.
Both 4.
And repeat number 9 again, you said 4.
Yeah, 4 for the atomic number. The neutrons should be 5. Electrons, 4.
Okay.
In order to review anything from pages 7 or 8, I need to introduce another term, and that is isotopes. It is written on the top of page 6. Okay, so you may have heard of the word iso, or that prefix iso, before. What does that prefix tell us?
Same.
Same. Good. So here's the catch. You just have to remember what is same about isotopes. First of all, these are atoms of the same element. That's what is same. Atoms of the same element. Okay, so isotopes are atoms of the same element. Because they're atoms of the same element, they should have the same numbers of protons. If they're neutral, they should also have the same numbers of electrons. Yeah, so isotopes are atoms of the same element. They have the same numbers of protons. So let's just take that and run with it. We have 3 carbon atoms up here. Yeah, of course they're carbon atoms. We can take that for granted, but let's confirm they're atoms of the same element. Atoms of the same element all have the same atomic number. And that atomic number here is what?
6.
And you can confirm that by looking at how many?
Protons.
You got it, protons. So every one of these atoms has 6 positive protons in the nucleus. that tells me, oh, hey, wait, these are all atoms of carbon. So right off the bat, that confirms for me that these are isotopes of the same element. Okay, so what makes them different from one another is their numbers of neutrons. You'll notice that this one on the far left, carbon 12, has only 6 neutrons. The one in the middle has 7. Over here on the right, we've got 8 neutrons. We may or may not change the number of electrons. That's not our concern right now. What we're really focused on is how many neutrons each of these atoms is going to carry. So here's the catch about isotopes. They are atoms of the same what? Same element. They have differing numbers of neutrons. Good. Okay, so how do you confirm that atoms belong to the same element? By their atomic number, and you can figure that out by looking at their protons. Good.
So we started with these two atoms earlier today. Can you tell me if they're atoms of the same element?
No.
How come you know they're not?
Different protons.
Right, different numbers of protons. The first atom we drew had 14 protons. Its neighbor over here had 7. Those are not atoms of the same element. They're different elements. So would you consider them isotopes to each other?
No.
I would not either, right. I would think of isotopes kind of like siblings of the same family. They may have the same last name, but their first names differ. So isotopes have to belong to the same element. They just have differing numbers of neutrons. So you may say, why are we talking about this? Well, one of the reasons we talk about it is if you look at the periodic table, you'll notice that sometimes there's point so-and-so, like here silicon has 28.1. The reason for that is they calculate the number of most common isotopes on Earth, and they say, well, there's actually more of one type of isotope than another, and therefore they get these fractions or decimal points for all of these elements on the periodic table. So I know that on class last Thursday, some of you raised your hand and said you were going into radiology tech, if I'm not mistaken. If you're doing radiology tech, you're going to work with radioactive isotopes. Radioactive isotopes decay over a certain period of time, and during the time that they're active in your body, they can glow and be picked up by a machine. It doesn't mean you truly glow. It just means that a certain kind of machine can detect that isotope in your system. Give it 24 to 48 hours, and that isotope rapidly decays, and then it's no longer detectable by machinery. So that's why we talk about radioactive isotopes, or just isotopes in general. They are certain types of elements here have, you know, one isotope is maybe more common than another. So let's go back to carbon for just a moment. Carbon has 3 different isotopes here, carbon 12, 13, and 14. And you may guess which one is the most common of those 3 isotopes when you look at this periodic table. There you go. Carbon 12 is your by far most common isotope on this periodic table. So I just want to kind of give you a little background history there about isotopes and why we use them and why we even discuss about them in this class. So now that we've talked about them, you can actually use that information to help you complete page 7. Okay, so one more example. These are labeled as isotopes of oxygen. How do you know they're isotopes? Same number of protons. They have 8 protons. That is our atomic what? That's our atomic number, right? So we can confirm that these are isotopes of oxygen because they both have 8 protons. What is different between these two atoms? Picture. Neutrons, right. So one has 8, one has 10. Do we really need to look at the electrons to determine if it's an isotope?
No.
No, we can ignore the electrons in this conversation. So sometimes electrons are important to the conversation. For isotopes, not important at all. Just look at the number of protons, look at the number of neutrons. So I want to make a point here. Since we're talking about isotopes and the numbers of protons and neutrons, what also is different from one atom to another? What do you add protons and neutrons and get?
The mass.
The mass. So if you were to look at the mass of the atom on the left, what is the weight of that atom? 16. Yep, and there you go. They'll often put the mass to the left of the symbol, and that tells you we're dealing with, you know, oxygen 16. It's a particular isotope we're working with. This one over here says oxygen 18, and if you look and confirm, 8 and 10 in the nucleus, that's our mass of this element, so this atom. So you'll oftentimes see these referred to by their mass, because that's how we know they're different from one another. Do you have any questions on how isotopes are identified or how you can know you're working with one? Anything I can clarify for you here? Okay, if you have not yet worked on page 7, now you've got the tools needed to do the isotopes on that page. The information on page 8 are your answers. So if you have had an opportunity to work on that page, are there any parts that you have questions on?
Questions 11 and 12.
11 and 12, okay. At the very bottom? Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you have number 11 there, it says, if an atom has an atomic number of 8, how many positive charges does the atom have? All right, so positive charges are protons, and protons are the atomic number. So you've got 8 positive charges.
Okay.
Yeah,
number 12? It would be 13.
Yep, you're sure right. It would be, well, if atom has an atomic number of 13, how many negative charges does it have? You could guess 13, but we really need the mass to be able to know that. So, no, we don't need the mass. We don't need the mass. We just need the number. So we just need to know that it's neutral, is what I was trying to say. Yeah. So we'll just assume it's neutral. That makes our lives easier than having to guess if it's transferred or shared. The top of the page has a chart. You'll need to keep in mind that some of those are, in fact, isotopes. And once you keep that in mind, you'll say, okay, oxygen 16 and 17. 17 doesn't have hardly any information in the box. Knowing that it's an isotope will help you complete the box for oxygen 17. You can use the atomic number and the mat or the protons and electrons for oxygen 16. All right, any questions on page 7? We can come back to it. If you work on it between now and Thursday, let me know. I'll be happy to come back to it for you. So we're going to talk about chemical bonds for just a few minutes. And in order to understand chemical bonds, let me go back to an atom that we were looking at earlier. All right, so let's take a look at the atom on the left. The atom on the left, right now we want to specifically pay attention to that valence shell. And on the valence shell, how many electrons do you see?
Eight.
Would you say it's a stable atom or a reactive atom?
Stable.
So it's really not going to be interested in forming a chemical bond. It's not going to be part of our story. The atom on the right, however, has only 4 electrons. Would you say it's chemically active or reactive or stable?
Reactive.
It's reactive. So we're not going to worry about stable. We're going to worry instead about reactive atoms, because their goal is to create a stable valence shell. And the magic number for stability is how many?
8.
And that's known as what rule?
Octet
rule. So there's the goal here that we need to think about in terms of chemical bonds. The goal is to ensure that we have a stable valence shell. And so that'll take us over to page 9 at the top. Why do atoms form bonds? It's all about stability. Atoms will either transfer their electrons through ionic bond formation, or they will share their electrons. That is called covalent bond formation. All right, so let's tackle those ionic bonds first. for right now, let's ignore what's on the right-hand side of the screen, and instead let's focus on the two atoms on the left-hand side. Over here, we've got an atom that has one electron in its valence shell, and its neighbor has seven electrons in the valence shell. Are either of these stable currently?
No.
Okay, so do you kind of see what's probably going to happen? That one which I've colored red is probably going to ditch that atom and come and sit on its neighbor's orbital. So why do that? Why be pulled away from the neighboring atom?
It's easier to give one away.
Yeah, it's easier to give one away. It's going to make both of those atoms stable. So in the after picture, you'll notice that that's in fact what we did. This atom on the left gave away its one and only lonely electron on its valence shell. That electron now resides on the neighbor's valence shell. It is a win-win situation. So the atoms here have a reason to hang out near each other because there was a transfer of an electron between the atoms. What did we get out of this whole relationship? What did we do for these two atoms? Both are stable, right? Their valence shells are stable. We've talked a lot about the octet rule. We have satisfied the octet rule on the atom on the right, meaning we now have how many electrons?
Eight.
That's our goal, right? Eight is stable. On the left, though, we've only got two. There's a name for that. It's called the duet rule. So we've actually made that atom stable with just having two. Okay?
On the board, the circle that has the number in it, you actually put them on there. So what's the difference now? So is this, they're not really that circle there, where inside of the nine, that's not actually a...
That's not a shell.
Okay,
that's
my
right.
First shell is the outer shell.
Yeah, that is your first shell. You're exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just isolating my nucleus so that it was kept away from my orbitals.
Okay, so that's what I'm saying. My nucleus and my orbitals are two different things.
Bingo.
So nothing sits on my nucleus.
Correct.
It's my outer shell after the nucleus.
Yeah, there's one shell, and that's your outer or valence shell.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly right.
Okay.
And this one here is not a shell. That's just my nucleus.
And this is the first orbital.
That's right.
Okay.
And I'm using the word orbital and shell interchangeably to mean the same thing. If y'all take chemistry, they're not. But for our conversation, we can use them interchangeably. Okay. Good for catching that. That's a good detail to notice. Okay, so let's see what we've got. Sometimes you may not get to see the ionic bond in motion. You may just see what's happened afterwards. And one way to confirm that you've had a transfer of electrons is to check and see if you've got stable valence shells. So I'll give you a moment to count the valence shells for each of these atoms and see if we have eight.
Mm-hmm.
Eight on this valence,
mm-hmm.
Eight on this valence. Okay, so we satisfied the octet rule for both of these atoms, so that's one clue that we've had a transfer of electrons. What is another clue that there's been a transfer?
Because the protons is like 11, and there's only 10 in the shell.
That's it.
Okay.
You got it. Good. So, you know, we were talking about this whole issue of just assuming that atoms were neutral. And if I come with that assumption, I would look at this one and I would say, hey, there's 11 protons. If I assume it's neutral, there should be how many electrons?
11.
And if I count, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Hold that thought. There's not the same numbers of electrons as protons. Looks like I'm short an electron. Hold that thought and check the neighbor. With 9 protons, it should have had how many electrons?
9.
But it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Looks like this one gained an electron. So when you do the math there and just count, you realize, hey, there's been a transfer. One electron came from the neighbor. It is now sitting on this orbital over here. Okay, so check and see if you've got stable valence shells. And then check your protons and electrons. If there's an you know, one is lost, one is gained, there's been a transfer. And when you have a transfer, what type of bond is this?
Ionic.
Ionic, good. So would it be fair to say these are neutral?
Together,
yeah, but by themselves,
no.
They're not. And the reason they're not is because
protons
and electrons are different, right? Somebody lost, somebody gained. Okay, so let's figure out who lost the electrons by looking at these orbitals. This atom on the left should have had 11 electrons. I know that because protons is 11, okay? So I am missing a charge. This one lost an electron. You know the old saying, it's always better to give than receive. If this one gives away an electron, it's going to carry a positive charge. And so we're going to call it what?
Cation.
Good.
You say if this one gave away?
Gave away. It's going to be a positive charge. And the reason for it is you have one extra proton because you lost an electron.
Okay. We can do the math over here. That'll help me see it. Okay, so the atom on the left had 11 positive protons. If you count the total electrons, there's only 10 total there. Just doing the math, that means I've got one extra positive charge. This tells me we lost an electron or we gave that electron away. And this, of course, is now called an ion. It's a special type of ion called a cation. Another way to remember this is that positive charge, there's the positive charge right there in the cation. Okay. So cations have lost electrons. They carry a positive charge. And you know, you can lose 1, 2, 3, you know, sometimes even 4 electrons. So cations may not lose just one, maybe multiple more. I am guessing that somewhere along your pathway to this course, you have learned prefixes and suffixes and all that good stuff. The prefix "and" means what? Without or negative. Yeah, so a lot of textbooks will define it as negative, and that's what I'm looking for, because anions carry a negative charge. That is because they gained electrons. Just count one more time. There's actually 9 protons there. And how many total electrons? Looks like 10, right? So if we just do the math, I've got one extra negative charge. Yeah, so that's going to make this one on the right an anion. So why do you think these two atoms hang out together?
One's got what the other
needs. So since there was a transfer, these two atoms hang out. They're like, you know, lifelong buddies. Because there was a transfer, they're going to stay kind of nearby each other. I want you to notice, though, they're not touching each other. There's not that kind of love between these two. There is just enough attraction because there's been a transfer of that electron. So they tend to hang out near each other for that reason. A lot of the ions in your body are cations, anions. There's things like calcium, potassium, magnesium. They fall into these categories. And a lot of the chemicals in your body form between cations and anions, like hydrochloric acid in your stomach, comes between a cation that's positively charged hydrogen and a negatively charged chlorine ion. So there's that attraction there between those two chemicals. So this is kind of touching the tip of an iceberg of where we're going to head with this throughout both 210 and 211. So what I want you to feel comfortable with is being able to spot an ionic bond and be able to identify your cation and anion. I'm going to go through some more examples. Hopefully we'll get you there to that comfort level before you leave today.
So I thought this was kind of a fun analogy. It's really fast. It's like a dog with a bone. Okay? Notice they both had the bone. They had a tumble. And that one got both bones, so it, of course, took that extra electron, and it got a negative charge because it picked up that extra electron. And since the one on the left there lost, it of course, has a positive charge. All right, so let's switch gears. We'll come back to that in just a moment. Let's switch gears and talk about covalent bonds. That's on page 9. By the way, let me answer those questions before we pass them by. After the transfer, it says, what does Li with a plus indicate? What does the plus tell us?
Cation,
right. Does that mean it gained or lost electrons?
Lost,
good. And F, it looks like a minus, but it's a negative symbol. You cannot see it, right. There's a teeny tiny negative symbol there, and that tells us fluorine is an anion. Meaning what?
Gained,
that's right. Okay, any questions so far about ionic bonds? All right, bottom of the page there is covalent bonds. Just take a look at the word before we go any further. Co as a prefix means what?
Together.
You got it. So valent means valence. And so literally the valent shells are together when you've got a covalent bond. We'll take a look at the before picture. These are two hydrogen atoms. Are they stable?
No.
You know this because? Supposed to have two electrons in the valence shell. That's that duet rule. That's what we would think of as a stable atom if it only has that innermost orbital. But unfortunately, only one electron there means it is reactive and looking for a way to stabilize that valence shell. So after they form a bond, you'll notice that the valence shells, in fact, are together. There's that covalent portion of the name of this bond. And those electrons are being shared in a pair. And that's the only way you share is in a pair. So think about it this way. If you know somebody that wears your shoe size and you would like to borrow their shoes, you don't come and say, hey, today I'd like your left shoe because I'm going to wear that one out. Don't want your right shoe. It's always pairs of electrons. So you'll notice that, yeah, in fact, we do have a pair that's being shared. And in fact, they travel around the speed of light, orbiting one nucleus and then the other nucleus. So they're going to spend their time orbiting those nuclei. This one is a particular kind of covalent bond. It is called a nonpolar covalent bond. What does that mean?
Shared equally.
So you might think of them as twins doing the sharing. Nobody's got one up on the other. They're equally sharing the electrons, and that means the electrons are going to be orbiting the nuclei at about the same pace. You know, there's going to be an equal amount of time spent orbiting each nucleus. So these are our two hydrogens here that are sharing equally those electrons. Oh, if it was only this easy all the time, right? Okay, so if you have siblings, you know, or if you have kids yourself, you know that they're not always going to share fair. They oftentimes share unfair. So that's what we call a polar covalent bond. Okay? So in this case, we do not have equal sharing of electrons. We've got somebody who's a bully. And the bully on the playground always says, that's my ball, I want to play with it. Or that's my whatever, right? So in the case of polar covalent bonds, there's going to be an atom or two that has a bully effect and pulls the electrons toward it. So this is actually a situation of water. You've got oxygen here, which is a big atom. You've got two hydrogens. Can you confirm for me that the orbitals here are all stable?
Yes.
And you know this because two there orbit that hydrogen, those two orbit that hydrogen. Yeah, and you got 8 there orbiting that oxygen. So it looks like we're all good in terms of the stable department. But what we've got going on is somebody says, I really like these electrons on my orbital. They're going to spend more time here with me. Who's the big bully in this molecule?
Oxygen.
Yeah, oxygen. Oxygen is big, and that's what makes it a bully. It says, I want these electrons. I really need them to stabilize my valence shell. They're coming to me. And so what charge do electrons carry? Negative. That makes oxygen slightly negative. And here's how we convey that to you. See that little squiggle? It's called delta. It's a lowercase d in the Greek language. Delta with a negative there says, I'm the bully. I'm the one stealing away all the electrons from everybody else. And because electrons are negative, the delta negative sits on the one who's most greedy for the electrons. And by the way, that is pictured on the top of page 10. So if you're a hydrogen atom, your two electrons that are supposed to be shared for you are actually spending most of their time where?
Around the oxygen.
Around the oxygen. And poor old hydrogen is left with only its lonely proton, and protons carry a positive charge. That's why you see a delta positive sitting down here, because that's all hydrogen has. It's sitting there with its proton going, well, I wish I had my electrons, but they're playing on this playground up here. So delta positive means that's the one that's having the electrons pulled away from it.
Electrons being pulled away from delta positive?
From delta positive, that's right. So when you see any delta positives or delta negatives around molecules like this, flash bulb should go off and say, this is polar. Okay, let me flip back for just a moment. Notice our covalent bond that's nonpolar in nature has no delta positives, no delta negatives. That's because the sharing here is done how?
Equal.
Yeah, nobody's getting more than their fair share of their time with those electrons. But yeah, in these polar covalent molecules, there's going to be a tug of war between the bully atom and its neighbors that it's supposed to be sharing with. Let's take even a bigger step back. How do you know this is a covalent molecule and not ionic? It's sharing, and what's happening with the orbitals? They're stable and they touch. Yeah, they overlap and touch. Let me go back for just a moment. No touching orbitals here, right? Okay.
They're just friends.
They're just friends, yeah. And then you've got, you know, these... What's that?
They're hooked up.
They're hooked up. Except somebody's like, you know, the stalker in the situation, right? Because they're stealing away more of that time with those electrons. So this is water. I just wanted to make a point about it because it makes up like 60-some percent of your body's mass. That's a lot of your body to be made up of a polar covalent molecule. And of course, these hydrogen atoms, you know, if this had been nonpolar, they would have been sitting on either side, just like this. But because oxygen is being greedy, it warps the shape of the water molecule, and it looks like a set of Mickey Mouse ears. And so that is actually going to dictate the way your body has to behave. We have oils in our body that don't get along with polar covalent molecules. It's really setting the stage for where we're going. So you can see here again, there's those two hydrogens being pulled by those that huge oxygen atom there in the center. So if I were looking at a covalent molecule and trying to figure out if it's polar or nonpolar, what little clues give it away?
Those deltas.
Those deltas. Good. What do the deltas tell us?
Where the electrons spend most of their time.
Where the electrons spend most of their time. Good. And of course, that says, hey, I am a polar covalent molecule when you see those deltas. Great clue to look for come test day.
What delta? What is that?
that little squiggle and that little squiggle, it looks like a fancy D.
So if you see deltas, it's a covalent bond.
And more than that, it's polar covalent. Yeah. Okay, so these squiggly little D's are called deltas. They're a Greek letter D. Anytime you see them, it's not just covalent, it is polar covalent. That's the great clue they impart upon us.
Well, what about if you got a positive or a negative sign?
It's got to, because otherwise you don't know who the stealer of the electrons is going to be. All right, so just for comparison, nonpolar covalent molecules have an equal or a fair sharing of electrons, but boy, look what happens when you have polar covalent bonds happening. You've got somebody who's greedy pulling the electrons away from its buddy. There's still a share that's going on, but it's an unequal or unfair share with polar molecules. Water is our best example there. I noted on the worksheet, page 10, right dead center of the page, you know, sometimes drawing all of that stuff out gets to be really messy. And so what we can do is just shorthand this. If you want to indicate that there's a single pair of electrons being shared between atoms, all you have to do is just draw the chemical symbol, a single line, and then the next symbol. So, you know, this is quite a mess to draw out every time we want to talk about carbon sharing a pair of electrons with its neighbors. So we just do it this way. We just do a single line there. That represents a single covalent bond. Do you know if this is polar or nonpolar?
No.
Well, there's no deltas, right?
Oh, polar.
So it is
nonpolar,
because deltas mean there's a tug of war, right? Okay, so no deltas means it's a nonpolar. What does that mean about the sharing that's going on?
It's equal.
It's equal. Yep, so this carbon is sharing equal amounts of time with those electrons and the hydrogens. Okay, so what do I mean by one pair? There is a pair of electrons there being shared between each hydrogen and each carbon in this molecule. Now, sometimes you have atoms that will form double covalent bonds, and here you've got an overlap of the orbitals, and we have four electrons lined up on that sharing line between the two. So that's a mess. I don't want to draw that out every time we're talking about oxygen sharing electrons with oxygen. Instead, you can do the double lines like you see at the very top. It looks like an equal sign. It's actually not. But those double lines indicate how many pairs of electrons being shared?
Two.
And if you were to count the total number of electrons shared, there are, in fact, four. Yeah, so it's like two pairs of shoes is actually four individual shoes. There they are, right there. This is real easy, right? Because three pairs of electrons is represented by how many lines?
Three
lines. So again, nitrogen with six total electrons or three pairs being shared is much easier written like this. Those three lines indicate covalent bonding. It indicates that we have a share going on and there's three pairs of electrons in the share. Hey, is this one polar or nonpolar?
Nonpolar.
Nonpolar. Don't see any deltas, exactly, good. And hey, they're identical twins, they're probably not gonna steal from each other, they're gonna share fair. So just for a way of review, on the left here, we have hydrogens sharing electrons with carbon. Those bonds are all described as what?
Single,
good. In the middle picture, do you notice a double bond? Between the carbons, right there. And how many pairs of electrons are shared?
Two
pairs. And the triple bond in the far right picture, how many pairs of electrons are shared?
Three.
And you know this is a triple bond because?
Three
lines. Are any of these classified as ionic bonds? No, because they are They're stuck together. That's right. They're sharing those electrons. Are any of these polar in nature? There are no delta symbols, right? So just a couple of things to keep in mind. We've got to step back and look at the big picture every now and again, right? Are you with me so far? Have I lost you anywhere? I have lost you. I'm going to review, so we're not going to leave this behind without completely going back through it.
Okay. Yeah, because we know it when you say it.
Then you leave and it's like, it's gone, yeah. Okay, one last special type of bond is this one. It's called a hydrogen bond. There is a lot going on in this picture, so let's break it down. These are water molecules. You know, water is H2O. We already know that this big atom is oxygen. Its two sidekicks are the hydrogens. Hey, there's my delta. What does that tell me about the relationship here?
Polar.
Fair, equal sharing, or tug of war?
Tug of war.
Tug of war. Who's pulling on those electrons?
Oxygen.
Oxygen, right. So these pairs of electrons shared with hydrogen are actually orbiting oxygen more than they are orbiting that hydrogen. All right, so in the water molecule, the delta negative goes to the atom that has more of the electrons, right? And the delta positive is sitting here because poor lonely hydrogen has a single proton, and it's charged in what way?
Positive.
So that's why we have a delta positive sitting on those hydrogens. That delta positive says, hey, that's all you really got is this one positive charge. So hydrogen, look at hydrogen. It says, you know, I had some electrons.
Oh God.
Where did they go? They went to
oxygen.
I can't get them back. What am I going to do? I want electrons. I can't get them from my own molecule, so where am I looking?
Somebody negative.
Yeah. So it says, you over there, you've got the electrons that I want. You've got that negative charge that I'm looking for. So here, this delta positive, this positively charged hydrogen, sees this massive negatively charged oxygen, and it says, there's where I want to be. I want to be attracted to that. So there's a slight bond formation between that hydrogen and a neighboring water molecule. And this is how it ends up looking. There's a water molecule, there's another one, there's another. And these dotted lines represent that attraction of the hydrogen toward a slightly negative charge on the neighbor.
It wants its baby back.
It says, I really want the negatives, right? So it's not a strong attraction, it's a weak attraction. But it's kind of like, you know, when magnets get together, you kind of feel them starting to pull before they snap and they lock together. It's that little surge that they're feeling. They're wanting to bond, but they don't fully bond. Okay, so it's a weak attraction between neighboring water molecules. That's what it mostly is in our bodies, is water attracting to water, but it can be any polar molecule attracted to any other polar molecule. You say, why the heck are we learning about this today? Right? Your body is what, 60% water? That is why your blood sticks together. That is why water beads on your skin before it evaporates and leaves as sweat, right? That is a big deal because most of your body is water, but you also have oils and waxes and fats that look at this conglomeration and say, oh no, I don't play with that. We don't get along at all. So we've got to find a way to get oils and fats to play nice with this massive setup here. So this is kind of where we're going to be going with this in the course. Okay, so take home message. What are hydrogen bonds? Are they weak or strong attractions? They're weak. It is an attraction between hydrogen and what? Some negative charge, right. Is it within its own molecule? No, it's a neighbor's molecule. It says, hey, things are looking good over there. I think I'll reach out, right? So there's a slight attraction to a neighbor's molecule. It's not inside the molecule. It's to a neighboring polar molecule. Weak attraction, Hydrogen is attracted to a slight negative charge. Okay? It's a weak attraction. And hydrogen is attracted to a slight negative charge. The easy way to spot it, it's represented by what? Dotted line. Yep. Get your dotted line. Bingo. Easy. Got yourself a hydrogen bond. Okay. So it's a weak attraction. Hydrogen is attracted to a weak negative charge, you know, on a neighboring molecule. And of course, best way to spot it, look for that dotted line. So we've been over enough for this stuff to turn to mud. So let's take a moment and go back and start from the beginning with the review. All right, so what kind of bond does this look like? It is ionic. Good. How do you know? They're not touching. And you've got a positive charge sitting above sodium and a negative above chlorine. Can you tell me if sodium is your cation or anion? Cation. That, of course, means chlorine's your anion. Which of these two atoms lost electrons? Yeah, sodium lost. It carries a positive charge. Of course, anions pick up extra electrons. They carry a negative charge. If you see like a Cl with a 1 minus there, or which they're not going to do, it's an understood 1. But if you see a 2 minus or a 3 minus, it tells you how many electrons were gained. Same thing here. If you see a 2 plus or a 3 plus, it tells you how many were lost. This is doing chemistry without actually doing chemistry. It's like shortcut chemistry. All right, what type of bond here, number 2? It is covalent, and the way you know it, easy to spot check those orbitals, right? They're touching. Okay, so touching orbitals, pairs of electrons are being shared, and no delta symbols means it's what type of covalent bond?
Nonpolar.
Good. Hey, if I were to shorthand this, and I didn't want to draw all this mess out every time, that pair of electrons is represented by how many lines? Just one. Good. So that would be an easy way to draw that out. All right, questions so far?
Can you draw it up?
Yeah.
I think I got it.
Perfect, that is exactly it, yeah. So the shorthand, you're exactly right. Everywhere there is a single bond is a single line.
Okay.
Bingo, good. A lot of single bonds here. We're looking at single bonds. All of these represent a pair of electrons being shared. What does these two lines mean?
Double bond.
And how many pairs of electrons?
Two.
Are these ionic or covalent? They're all covalent. Anytime you see lines, anytime you see overlapping orbitals, it's covalent. Okay. All right. Covalent or ionic? How do you know?
They're touching,
right? Overlapping orbitals. And in fact, it's kind of busy in here. There's a pair of electrons shared there and a pair of electrons shared there.
So I have two lines.
Good for you. It's two lines. Good. Is it a single, double, or triple bond?
Double.
So it's oxygen. Looks like an equal sign, but it's just two bonds to another oxygen. Okay. So covalent.
And that's it right there?
That's it. That's all there is to it, yeah. Polar, nonpolar? It's nonpolar, yep, so we don't have any delta symbols there. All right, what kind of bond is between the carbon and the fluorines around?
Covalent.
All covalent, and you know this because they're touching. And each one of these bonds, is it single, double, or triple?
Single.
Single. And every time we share electrons, it's done 2 by 4 by 6. It's always done in pairs. Easy to spot. You've got a dotted line. This is
hydrogen.
Good. Hydrogen bonds occur between polar molecules because there's that weird tug of war going on, and there's going to be an atom with delta positives and delta negatives. That's that attraction there. All right. Let's see. Type of bond between the two carbon atoms. It is covalent. It is double. Good. Polar or nonpolar?
Nonpolar.
It is nonpolar. Good. There's no delta symbols here. Good.
So even when they're drawn out like that, it still has a delta symbol?
It sure could. I'm not sure if I've got one. I don't have one, but they sure will put them on those kinds of drawings too. My last review one is this one. Lithium and fluorine have transferred an electron. It is classified how? It's ionic. Good. Okay. And you know this because the orbitals, how do they look? They're not touching. Yeah, there's no overlap. You're right. There's a positive and a negative there too. Good. Okay. We have just a few minutes left. I'm going to leave page 11 for you all to read, and I'm going to get a little bit over to page 14. Page 11 is just some basic chemistry stuff you may have seen before. If you'll read that for me, I'll be happy to answer questions or go over it for you. On Thursday, all right, so just for the last few minutes, I'd like to flip you over to page 14 and just work a little bit in some inorganic chemistry. So we're going to work today and Thursday on inorganic and organic chemistry. I know if you go to the grocery store, a lot of foods are advertised as being organic, and it's a joke to a science person because organic means life, yeah, and contains carbon. So, of course, if you've got like fruit and vegetables that are organic, yeah, there should be living organisms produced them. They should have carbon molecules in there. We're going to start, however, with the inorganic side of chemistry, and you'll notice that these are typically ionically bonded molecules or compounds. When we say ionically bonded, what has happened to the atoms that are in that relationship? Yeah, one's giving an electron away to another. There's a transfer of electron, and the result is cations and anions. Okay, most of these molecules or compounds in the inorganic category don't have much carbon. There's exceptions always. Carbon dioxide contains carbon, but it's definitely inorganic. We actually make inorganic compounds. We make hydrochloric acid. We make all sorts of different things that are classified as inorganic in nature. And what we mean is they don't typically have carbon molecules or atoms set up in them. And we don't really use made or not made by a living organism to distinguish between organic and inorganic. That's not going to be one of our factors here. Just for the sake of comparison, on the left is a picture of an inorganic molecule. You'll notice there's no carbon in it. I'm looking for the symbol C. And on the right is an organic molecule. Of course, there's a lot of carbons in this one. These carbon backbones are the basis for our organic molecules. So that right there, in a nutshell, is the difference between inorganic molecules and organic. It's really the amount of carbon that's in those molecules. So our probably best well-known inorganic molecule is water. Just take a moment and we'll run through water. We've already been here and talked about this a little bit today. Water molecules are considered polar. What does that mean about the sharing that's going on? Unequal. Good. Who is the one doing the pulling in that molecule? Oxygen, right. So of course it carries a delta negative for that reason. For our bodies, the fact that water is polar plays a huge role in the way that our body behaves or manages fats and oils and things of that sort. We know that oil and water don't mix, and that is because water is polar and there's unequal sharing going on. You know, our skin contains oils on the surface, and that's why water beads up. And if you're really dry, the water may not bead as well as if you've got lotion or some oils on your skin. That water beads up really nicely. Just like if you wax your car, that water will bead up because oil and water don't mix. And that has to do with the polarity. Water molecules do tend to stick together. The next term there, called cohesion, has to do with this ability for water molecules to stick. What is making these water molecules stick? Yeah, there's hydrogen bonds. And you know they're hydrogen bonds because they are dotted lines, right? So that is a huge underlying issue for our water inside our bodies. Blood sticks together partly because of the cohesiveness or stickiness of those water molecules. Hydrogen bonds, we've talked about that already. High heat capacity or high heat of vaporization. It says there that water resists changes in temperature. So if you go outside on a hot day like we've had often this summer and it's 100 degrees or 95 degrees, what happens to your body temperature over the next 5 to 10 minutes? It rises. Do you combust or catch on fire in the next 5 to 10? Thank gosh no, right? That is thanks to hydrogen bonds, and even though they're weak bonds, they're not willing to break. So if you stood outside for quite a long time, you're going to dehydrate. But water resists temperature changes. The fact that we're 60 to 70% water means that our bodies resist heating up too quickly or cooling off too quickly. Water is a good chemical reactant. It's a solvent in our bodies. And last for today is cushioning. There are two major water locations in your body, inside cells and outside cells. Intracellular, or ICF, is the name of the fluid inside your cells. That's where about two-thirds of your water is housed. An extracellular fluid is the fluid outside your cells. That's around one-third of your bodily fluids. We will definitely talk about water again and again in this course, especially related to where it's housed in your body's compartments. But on Thursday, we're going to start off with page 15. I can email you some practice problems that we can start class with on Thursday. Do you have a preference for what we review? That kind of stuff? Okay, we can do that. How about bonds? Bonds. Okay, I'll email you some stuff and we'll start with Thursday on that review. Okay, I'll send you some pictures. Okay. All right, I will see you all on Thursday.